From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Agotamos todos los procedimientos legales para extraditar.
We're trying now to use all of the instruments at our disposal to expedite him.
Algún sector del gobierno de Estados Unidos no permite la extradición.
But it's not moving forward. It's running into some resistance here in the United States.
Bolivian President Evo Morales talking about his predecessor, Gonzalo Sanchez de Sada, will speak with the Bolivian attorney, Rogelio Mehta, who's come to the United States to call for the former president's extradition for the 2003 massacre of more than 60 protesters. And Bolivian activist Oscar Oliveira will also join us in studio, one of the leading voices in the global anti-corporate globalization movement. Then on the eve of the fifth anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, we'll speak with an Afghan-American journalist who's closely monitoring U.S. reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan. But first, a man approaches Dick Cheney in a Denver mall and tells him he thinks his policies are misguided. He's now suing the U.S. government after he was arrested. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A longtime chief of staff of former Republican Congressmember Mark Foley has revealed he warned House Speaker Dennis Hastert about Foley's questionable contact with congressional pages nearly 3 years ago. Kirk Fordham says he told Hastert Chief of Staff Scott Palmer about Foley's, quote, inappropriate behavior in a face-to-face meeting. Palmer denies the encounter took place. Fordham says that meeting occurred well before Hastert learned of emails that Republicans say account for the only early reports of Foley's behavior. Hastert maintains he did not investigate because the emails were deemed to be over-friendly but not suggestive of inappropriate activity. In California, prosecutors have brought charges against the former chair of the technology giant Hewlett-Packard for her role in the company's spy scandal. Patricia Dunn stepped down last month amid growing speculation over her role in the company's surveillance of journalists and board members in an attempt to discover the source of information leaked to the media. Four other Hewlett-Packard officials were also indicted Wednesday, including the company's chief ethics attorney. President Bush has signed a law to build hundreds of miles of new fencing along the U.S.-Mexico border. The president held a signing ceremony Wednesday in Arizona.
The bill I signed today includes nearly $1.2 billion in additional funding for strengthening the border, for new infrastructure and technology that will help us do our job. It provides funding for more border fencing, vehicle barriers and lighting for cutting-edge technology, including ground-based radar, infrared cameras, and advanced sensors that will help prevent illegal crossings along our southern border. That's what the people of this country want.
The Mexican government strongly opposes the wall, saying it will lead to more deaths and injuries for those who come into the United States through dangerous terrain. In Ohio, a federal judge has struck down a voting law that required naturalized citizens to provide proof of citizenship if challenged by an election worker. The law was challenged by a group of naturalized citizens and a local chapter of the ACLU who said it would foster ethnic profiling at the polls. In Iraq, at least 60 people were killed in violence around the country Wednesday. 19 were killed when a suicide bomber struck an Iraqi military base in Ramadi. Meanwhile, the Iraqi government has announced it is deactivating and investigating a police brigade of more than 1,000 officers over possible links to death squads. The brigade is accused of complicity in the kidnapping Sunday of 26 workers in a district under its control. In other Iraq news, The Guardian of London's reporting the Iraqi education system is on the verge of collapse. Large numbers of students and teachers have fled the schools in the face of ongoing violence. Some schools have seen their student and staff numbers drop by more than half. Female students are routinely intimidated for failing to wear the hijab. Meanwhile, the U.S. military is suffering one of its worst weeks since the invasion. 14 U.S. soldiers have been killed since Monday. The military says that's the highest three-day total so far. A military spokesperson attributed the deaths to a record number of bomb attacks on U.S. troops. Meanwhile, a new poll by the veteran advocacy group VoteVets.org has found nearly two-thirds of troops who fought in Iraq and Afghanistan believe the military is overextended. The New York Times reports House Republicans have earmarked $20 million for a commemoration of success of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The funding was attached to the year's defense spending bill. The measure empowers President Bush to designate, quote, a day of celebration and to issue a proclamation calling on the people of the United States to observe that day with appropriate ceremonies and activities. The funding's allowed to roll over into 2007 if the president decides a celebration is not yet appropriate. In the occupied territories, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has announced talks for a national unity government with Hamas have broken down. Abbas says he may try to dissolve the government if he can't reach an agreement. Clashes between the two leading Palestinian factions have left 12 people dead in the last week. In Gaza, Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh of Hamas said the U.S.-led aid freeze on his government is hurting Palestinians and hindering chances at national unity.
There is an elected Palestinian government that expresses the will of the Palestinian voter, and it is a legitimate government. However, we have said that we have no problem with resuming the dialogue concerning the formation of unity government. But once again, I say, stay away from using this sort of time, and do not use the suffering of the Palestinian people to impose a political agenda on the region.
In Pakistan, the international aid agency Oxfam is warning nearly 2 million displaced people are at risk nearly 1 year after the massive earthquake that destroyed their homes. This is Oxfam's Farhana Farooqi Stocker.
We in Oxfam International, we estimate that approximately 1.8 million people will be living in makeshift transitional shelter over the winter months.
Oxfam says a recent survey of more than a dozen earthquake-hit villages found nearly all lacked adequate protection against the region's upcoming winter. In Indonesia, the Supreme Court has overturned the conviction of a pilot found guilty of murdering the leading human rights activist, Munir Talib. The pilot, Polycarpus Prianto, was aboard Talib's flight to Singapore in September of 2004. Prianto was convicted last year after evidence showed he gave Munir a poison glass of orange juice. But this week, the Indonesian Supreme Court ruled there was not enough evidence for a conviction. Munir was a prominent critic of the Indonesian government and military. Indonesia's state intelligence agency has also been implicated in his murder, but to date, no official has been brought to trial. Paraguay has announced it won't be renewing a military cooperation agreement with the U.S. because it refuses to grant immunity to U.S. troops. The Bush administration had been lobbying Paraguay to immunize U.S. forces from prosecution by the International Criminal Court. Paraguay becomes the latest South American country to refuse the demand, following Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, and Venezuela. And finally, in an update on a story we've covered on Democracy Now!, Amnesty International is accusing a Mexican police force of covering up the rape and abuse of demonstrators at a land rights protest earlier this year. The alleged abuse took place after more than 200 people were arrested in a massive crackdown in the town of San Salvador Atenco outside Mexico City in May. At least 23 female prisoners have lodged complaints of rape and sexual abuse. Amnesty International says police destroyed witness statements while prison doctors refused to look into the prisoners' allegations. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday, a federal lawsuit was filed against the U.S. government alleging civil rights violations. The lawsuit was filed by Stephen Howards, an environmental consultant in Colorado. He was arrested in June after he approached Vice President Dick Cheney in a mall and denounced the war in Iraq. The lawsuit is the third one that's been filed, charging Secret Service agents or White House staff members violated the law when they attempted to keep people with opposing views away from President Bush or Vice President Cheney. In another suit pending in Colorado, two people say they were kicked out of a public event where Bush was speaking because of an anti-war bumper sticker. And in West Virginia, the ACLU has filed a lawsuit on behalf of two people who were arrested in appearance by President Bush because they were wearing anti-Bush T-shirts. Stephen Howards joins us now from Denver, where he filed the suit on Wednesday in federal district court. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Why don't you explain exactly what happened? What day was it?
I think it was the middle of June, and I was
in Beaver Creek, Colorado, with my two kids, accompanying them to a piano camp. And that morning, I'd read about the deaths, the rising death toll in Iraq, and who walks by me but Mr. Cheney. And to be honest, I couldn't resist the temptation. So I approached Mr. Cheney and told him that I thought his policies in Iraq were absolutely reprehensible.
Just 1 sec. He, by sure. himself, walked by you in a mall, Vice President Dick Cheney?
Well, you know, yes. There was apparently, Gerald Ford has an annual kind of get-together of political VIPs, if you will, that, I don't know, discuss world issues. And I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to cross Mr. Cheney. Mr. Cheney was actually going across an outdoor mall, kind of a pedestrian mall in Beaver Creek, Colorado. And there were lots of Secret Service agents, but he was walking through, taking some time, shaking hands. There were probably more Secret Service agents there than there were members of Joe Public. But I waited my turn, and I walked up to Mr. Cheney, and I told him what I thought. And then I quickly exited because I didn't want to create a scene or give anyone opportunity to cause me any problems.
And so what happened next?
Well, I then continued on, took my child to piano camp, came back about 10 minutes later, because if you know this area, you've got to pass through the same area. And I was approached by a Secret Service agent who accused me of assaulting the vice president. My 8-year-old son was standing next to me at that point in time. His exact words were, did you assault the vice president? And I said, no, I didn't. But I did tell him the way I felt about the war in Iraq, and if Mr. Cheney wanted to be shielded from public criticism, he should avoid public places. And I closed by telling the agent that if freedom of speech was against the law, he should arrest me. At which point he grabbed me, cuffed my hands behind my back, and started carting me across the mall. I stopped and told him I could not abandon my 8-year-old son in the middle of a public mall. At which point he responded, we'll call social services. Fortunately, on the way out, we passed my wife, who, my son was with my wife. He had run off in terror. He wouldn't even talk. He was so scared. They took me to jail with my hands cuffed behind my back for 3 hours. The Secret Service agent told my wife, myself, and anyone else that would listen that I was being charged with assaulting the vice president. Those charges were later reduced to harassment. And 2 weeks later, or 3 weeks later, the charges were dismissed altogether.
What happened to you during that time? During that 2 weeks, did other people see you being arrested? Did they know who you were?
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. No, it was a scene. I was treated as though I was a convict, like a criminal. It was horrifying for my kids. So we waited for a few weeks. Actually, we left. We were going on vacation. We left a few days later. This actually happened 2 days before Father's Day, so it was quite a memorable Father's Day, as you can imagine. We left a few days later for our vacation, and we got back in the mail. There was a notice that the charges had been dismissed. Apparently, the Secret Service had come to my office to try to see me, they would not leave their names. It was very Gestapo-ish, I must say, but I never returned their calls, and I have no reason why they came to my place of work. And that's it.
And why have you decided to sue the government now?
You know, because it's such a transparent attempt to suppress free speech. We view the suppressiveness of free speech we view the suppressiveness of free speech and the assault that this administration has made on our constitutional rights to free speech as a greater threat to the future of this country than Osama bin Laden ever will be. First, this administration argued that if you criticize their policies, you were, in fact, providing support to people like Osama bin Laden. You were boosting the threat to national security. Then they suggested that if you oppose their policies, you are actually equivalent to a Nazi sympathizer. The nation is united on the need to fight terror. That's not an issue. The issue is how this administration has gone about choosing to do that. And lots of people are very upset about that. And now the administration has forged the final link by suggesting that If you exercise your constitutional rights to free speech in opposing this administration's policies in Iraq, you are therefore posing a threat to national security and subject to arrest. And I don't know about the rest of America, but I find that thought and that logic, that twisted logic, absolutely terrifying. So we brought the lawsuit to really expose this issue and to raise the question of, do we in fact still live in a free nation where people are free to express their opposition to the government policies?
What are you asking for? Okay,
right now, we're asking for a jury to, we're actually deferring to a jury to decide what the, what the resolution to this matter should be. What we're asking for is some acknowledgement by the Secret Service and by the administration that people have a right to free speech. We're asking for an apology to my kids for the wrongful arrest and search that occurred. And if any financial rewards or any financial settlement comes of this, that's great, but that's not the goal of the lawsuit. And if any financial rewards come, they'll go to a charitable organization. That's not our goal here.
Isn't the vice president immune from prosecution as he sits in office?
This is a civil suit, and it's against the Secret Service officer who did the arrest. After he arrested us, and again threatened my wife and myself, saying he was going to spend all day Monday in the U.S. Attorney's office ensuring that felony assault charges were brought against us, he then gave us his business card. So we know exactly who arrested us, and this is actually a civil suit against a Secret Service agent.
Stephen Howards, I want to thank you very much for being with us again. Arrested a few days before Father's Day on harassment charges, first on assault charges, then lowered to harassment charges for approaching Dick Cheney in a mall in Colorado. This is Democracy Now. Thank you very much for being with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Coming up on the broadcast, we'll be looking at so-called reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan as we move into this fifth anniversary of the attack on Afghanistan. We'll speak with an Afghan-American reporter who is here in this country looking at the money that has been spent in Afghanistan and what are the results. But first, after break, we'll be joined by the leading human rights activist in Bolivia, as well as an attorney who's come here to seek the extradition of a former Bolivian president. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A Bolivian human rights delegation is visiting the U.S. this week to seek the extradition of ex-Bolivian President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lasada and two of his former ministers. They're requesting the U.S. government notify the three men of their obligation to return to Bolivia immediately to stand trial for the massacre of scores of protesters 3 years ago. Lasada, Carlos Sanchez Bersain, and Jorge Berendog have all resided in the United States since fleeing Bolivia in 2003 following a citizens' uprising that removed them from power. The conflict arose following a decision by Sanchez de Lasada government to export Bolivia's natural gas through a port in Chile. When hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets in protest, government forces responded with soldiers and tanks, killing 67 of the protesters, wounding more than 400. Rogelio Maita is an attorney representing the families killed in the gas war. He's in the U.S. this week to urge U.S. government officials to notify the three men to return to Bolivia for trial. The trial cannot proceed without formal notification. Rogelio Maita joins us in our Firehouse studio. We're also joined by Oscar Oliveira, the executive secretary of the Bolivian Federation of Factory Workers and spokesperson for the Committee in the Defense of Water and Life in Cochabamba. Oscar emerged in 2000 as the leader of the nationwide protest movement against water privatization in Bolivia. He's in New York for a conference at the Cornell Global Labor Institute, where he's meeting with trade union leaders and labor-based researchers from a number of countries. They're being translated by Tom Fritsch, and we welcome you all to Democracy Now! Rogelio Maita, explain exactly what happened in 2003.
Rogelio, explique, por favor, es precisamente lo que pasó en 2003.
En el segundo periodo presidencial de Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada, Bolivia vivía un tiempo de mucha pobreza y desempleo.
During the second term of President Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada, Bolivia was living through a term, a period of high unemployment and poverty.
Bolivia ha vivido históricamente el saqueo de sus recursos naturales.
Bolivia has experienced historically the exploitation of its natural resources.
Y en ese tiempo se quería exportar el gas en condiciones absolutamente desfavorables para el pueblo boliviano.
During that period, the government wanted to export the gas under very unfavorable terms for the Bolivian people.
Los movimientos sociales, el pueblo, se ha movilizado para oponerse a esa posibilidad.
The social movements and the people had mobilized in order to oppose that possibility.
El gobierno del entonces presidente Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada.
The government of that of then President Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada.
Bajo el argumento de dar seguridad jurídica a las transnacionales.
Under the argument of giving legal security to transnationals.
Ha dispuesto la represión militar de la protesta social.
Began military repression of social protests.
En esos días, principalmente entre el 20 de septiembre y los primeros días de octubre del 2003,
In those days, especially between the 20th September and the first days of October of 2003,
se han realizado verdaderas operaciones militares frente a población civil desarmada.
There were true military operations against unarmed civilian populations.
Se trataba de amedrentar, de asustar a la gente para que deje de protestar.
It was about scaring the people so that they would stop protesting.
Han muerto 67 personas. Han sido asesinadas 67 personas.
67 people have been murdered.
Y más de 400 han resultado heridas.
And more than 400 were wounded.
Por las acciones de represión militar.
Because of the military repression actions.
Entre ellos, una niña de 8 años.
Among them were a girl of 8 years old.
Un niño de 5 años.
And a 5-year-old boy.
Well, 2 weeks ago, we had an hour-long conversation with Bolivian President Evo Morales. He was in New York for the United Nations General Assembly. In one of his first extended televised interviews in the United States, Morales talked about Latin America, U.S. foreign policy, the role of the indigenous people of Bolivia, and he called on the U.S. to extradite his predecessor, President Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada.
Públicamente, ya quiero aprovechar esta oportunidad mediante ustedes para que el pueblo norteamericano exija a que el gobierno de Estados Unidos expulse a los genocidas, delincuentes, corruptos que vienen o se hacia Estados Unidos y buscan protección acá.
I'm not sure that's probably something for the United States to take up, but I want to take advantage of this opportunity to call on the people of the United States to help us in our efforts to extradite to Bolivia those people who practiced genocide, who were corrupt under previous administrations, and who today are free here in the United States.
Names?
¿Quiénes?
Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada.
Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada, former president.
Que el 2003, el 2004, acribilló cerca o más de 100 personas a bala usando las Fuerzas Armadas y la Policía Nacional junto a su ministro de Gobierno, Sánchez Berceín,
y junto who in 2003 was responsible for the death of over 100 people killed in, by gunfire, along with his minister, Carlos Sánchez Berceín.
Agotamos todos los procedimientos legales para extraditar.
We're trying now to use all of the instruments at our disposal to extradite him.
Algún sector del gobierno de Estados Unidos no permite la extradición.
But it's not moving forward. It's running into some resistance here in the United States.
Sea una lucha contra el terrorismo, contra una defensa de los derechos humanos de un estado, de un país, de un gobierno como de Estados Unidos. Sea lucha contra la corrupción. No es posible que esos señores estén acá.
A government that says it fights against terrorism, for human rights, against corruption, it's not conceivable that this person would still
es
be here.
Es un pedido no solamente al pueblo ni al gobierno, sino a todas las instituciones defensoras de los derechos humanos.
So we ask the people, the government, and all the institutions of human rights to help with this.
Bolivian President Evo Morales speaking to us several weeks ago in New York City. Our guest, Rogelio Maita, attorney who's come to ask for the extradition of the president and two ministers, and will also be speaking with Oscar Oliveira. Rogelio Maita, you have photographs. For our listeners, we'll post them on our website at democracynow.org. For our viewers, if you would hold them up and describe them.
Usted tiene fotos, por favor, álcelos para que los leantes los vean y explíquelos, por favor.
La resistencia del pueblo boliviano
the resistance
ha sido
of the Bolivian people
resistencia pacífica
has been a peaceful resistance.
Civiles frente a fuerzas armadas.
Civilians against armed forces.
Gente protestando pacíficamente.
People protesting peacefully.
Y respondida con armamento o letal.
Answered with lethal weapons.
No se habla de que ha habido una guerra del gas.
It's not that there's been a gas war.
Es falso.
That's false.
Guerra hay cuando hay dos bandos armados.
A war is when there are two armed groups.
En Bolivia, en octubre del 2003, ha habido una masacre.
In Bolivia, in October 2003, there was a massacre.
Lozada, the former president, how did he end up in the United States?
¿Cómo llegó el antiguo presidente Lozada a los Estados Unidos?
El 17 de octubre del 2003, después de renunciar, viene directamente acá a los Estados Unidos.
October 17, 2003, after resigning, he came directly to the United States.
Ahora estamos acá preocupados. Y apenados.
Now we're worried.
Porque el gobierno de los Estados Unidos está impidiendo, está obstruyendo que los centenares de víctimas puedan tener justicia.
because now the United States government is impeding and obstructing a process for the hundreds of victims to have justice.
Did Losada, the former Bolivian president, come to the U.S. in a U.S. plane?
¿Vino el antiguo presidente a los Estados Unidos en un avión norteamericano?
Ha venido en una aerolínea comercial.
Uh-huh. He came in a commercial airline.
Have you specifically asked the State Department? Have you specifically requested the U.S. government his extradition?
¿Han pedido específicamente al gobierno estadounidense su extradición?
Todavía no. De acuerdo a la ley boliviana, antes de proceder a la extradición,
not yet, under Bolivian law, before proceeding to extradition,
se le debe dar a conocer las denuncias que pesan contra él.
We have to show the charges that are against him.
Pero hace un año y medio, o un año y tres meses, más bien, que el gobierno de los Estados Unidos no da curso a la solicitud del gobierno boliviano para realizar esa actuación.
But for the last year and three months, the United States government has not listened to the Bolivian petition to realize that request.
Y sin esa actuación, no podemos proseguir el proceso.
Without that action of notification, we cannot continue with the process.
No hablamos todavía de la extradición.
So we're not even talking about extradition yet.
Solo de una actuación inicial.
We're only talking about an initial action.
Mm. I wanted to go to another comment of Bolivian President Evo Morales, who talked about the importance of natural resources in Bolivia, and specifically the issue of water in indigenous communities.
Y siento también para resolver el tema de la vida, el tema de la humanidad, el tema del medio ambiente, y cómo salvar al planeta Tierra para salvar a la humanidad, es importante democratizar las Naciones Unidas.
I think it's important to democratize the United Nations so that we can deal with issues like humanity, how to save the planet, how to avoid wars.
El movimiento indígena no solamente vive en solidaridad con el prójimo, sino en armonía con la madre tierra.
The indigenous communities live in harmony not only with their fellow persons, but also with Mother Earth.
Y nos preocupa muchísimo que el llamado calentamiento del planeta Tierra nos está dejando escasez de agua.
And we're very worried about global warming that's leaving people without water.
Por decir, antes la laguna era hasta aquí y ahora solamente hasta aquí.
In the past we've seen the bodies of water that were up to a certain level are now
significa
declining.
Significa que en poco tiempo vamos a tener problemas muy serios.
That means that in a very short time we're going to have very serious problems.
Hasta sin luz podemos vivir. Con micheras, pero no podemos vivir sin agua.
Without light we can live with lamps, with oil lamps, but without water we can't live.
Bolivian President Evo Morales in our studio, as well as Rogelio Maita. We are joined by Oscar Olivera, perhaps the most well-known activist in Bolivia. And we welcome you to Democracy Now!, Oscar Olivera.
Gracias, Amy.
The issue of water. You are particularly well known for taking on a major U.S. multinational, Bechtel. Tell us what happened in Cochabamba and where that stands today.
En la cuestión del agua, usted es más conocido por enfrentar al multinacional estadounidense Bechtel. Díganos qué está pasando actualmente con la situación en Cochabamba con el agua.
Bueno, en realidad el que ha enfrentado a la Bechtel, al Banco Mundial y a los gobiernos cómplices para convertir el agua en una mercancía ha sido el pueblo.
In reality, the confrontation with Bechtel and other businesses has been the proposition of converting water into a commodity.
Nosotros simplemente hemos sido portavoces de esas demandas de la gente de que el agua no puede convertirse en una mercancía.
We've only been spokespeople for that demand that water should not be converted into a commodity.
Después de seis años, el tema del agua en Cochabamba no ha concluido.
Six years later, the matter of water in Cochabamba has not been concluded.
Existen intentos del Banco Mundial y de la cooperación internacional de privatizar el agua.
There are still attempts from the World Bank with international cooperation to privatize water.
Existen las amenazas de cualquier rompimiento de contratos con empresas multinacionales de agua que todavía están operando en Bolivia puedan ser dirimidas en tribunales internacionales en el Banco Mundial.
Still, any breach of contract with the multinationals could be submitted to tribunals in the World Bank.
But could you explain, though it's well known in Bolivia, hardly known here at all, though it's a U.S. company, what happened in Cochabamba? Talk about what Bechtel tried to do and what the people responded.
Pero aunque sea bien conocida en Bolivia, aquí casi no se conoce, aunque es una corporación norteamericana, ¿qué precisamente trató de hacer Bechtel y qué fue la respuesta del pueblo?
No es que trató de hacer, lo hizo Bechtel en Bolivia. Elevó las tarifas de agua hasta un 300%.
It's not that Bechtel tried to do it, they did it. They increased the charges for water, the cost of water, by 300%.
Es decir, que cada familia debería pagar por el servicio de agua una quinta parte de su ingreso.
So that every family had to pay for the water service one-fifth of their income.
How did they get control of the water? I mean, here you turn on the tap, you don't pay.
¿Cómo llegaron a tener control del agua? Aquí nomás se usa la llave, no hay que pagar.
El gobierno, a través de una ley, entregó a la transnacional un área de concesión para que ellos puedan tener el monopolio absoluto del servicio.
The government, under a law that was passed, conceded control of the water under monopoly to Bechtel in a certain area.
Es decir, que Bechtel imponía las reglas a su antojo en función estrictamente de tener utilidades por un servicio tan elemental como es el que la gente pueda consumir el agua.
So that means that Bechtel tried to charge a fee and had the monopoly power over a very basic necessity for people.
La ley decía muy sutilmente que había que pedir permiso para acumular el agua de la lluvia.
The law said even that people had to ask, had to obtain a permit to collect rainwater.
Es decir, que el agua de la lluvia también estaba privatizada.
That means that even rainwater was privatized.
Lo más grave era que comunidades campesinas, comunidades indígenas que durante años habían utilizado sus fuentes de agua para el servicio.
The most serious thing was that indigenous communities and farming communities, who for years had their own water rights.
Esas fuentes de agua, a través de la ley, se creaba un mercado de agua y esas fuentes de agua podían ser compradas y apropiadas por empresarios transnacionales.
Those water sources were converted into property that could be bought and sold by international corporations.
Frente a esta situación, el pueblo se levantó, hubo una sublevación popular y movilizaciones que duraron 5 meses lograron parar esta privatización, se logró romper el contrato con la Bechtel y se cambió la ley.
In confronting that situation, the people rose up, confronted Bechtel, and during 5 months of mobilization, managed to defeat Bechtel, breach the contract, and change the law.
Pero lo más importante, y hay que hacerles recuerdo a Evo Morales, es que esa victoria el año 2000 del pueblo de Cochabamba posibilitó que hoy Evo Morales sea presidente de la República.
But the most important thing, and we need to remind Evo Morales of that today, was that that victory of the people in Cochabamba was the reason why Evo Morales can be president today.
Si esa victoria el año 2000 no hubiera terminado en eso, en una victoria popular, Evo Morales hoy no sería presidente de Bolivia.
If that uprising in 2000 had not ended in a popular victory, Evo Morales today would not be the president.
Why do you say you have to remind President Evo Morales?
¿Por qué dice que tiene que recordarle a Evo Morales?
Porque Evo no habla de ese importante hecho histórico donde él también participó. Pero él no fue el principal protagonista, ni Oscar Olivera. El principal protagonista, desde el año 2000 hasta el 18 de diciembre, que es elegido Evo Morales presidente, es el pueblo boliviano.
Because Evo does not talk today about that struggle. And he was not the principal protagonist in that struggle, nor was it Oscar Olivera. It was the Bolivian people, which up until the 18th of December, when Evo Morales was elected, was the primary protagonist in that struggle.
En este momento Evo Morales está en el gobierno porque el pueblo le ha colocado a él para que sigamos empujando juntos un proceso.
At this time, Evo Morales is in the government because the people put him there. so that we can continue pushing together.
Él tiene que estar, él está en el gobierno para obedecer lo que el pueblo tiene que, lo que el pueblo está decidiendo.
He is in the government to obey what the people has decided.
Él tiene que cambiar el sistema político y el sistema económico en el país.
He needs to change the political and economic systems of the country.
Por lo tanto, nosotros y Evo Morales vamos a empujar ese proceso que significa la recuperación de nuestros bienes comunes, pero también significa la recuperación de nuestra capacidad de decidir.
We're going to continue pushing forward that process, which means recovering our common goods as well as our capacity to decide.
Who died in that struggle back in 2000?
¿Quiénes murieron en esa lucha en 2000?
En Cochabamba murió un joven de 17 años, Víctor Hugo Daza, y murieron cuatro indígenas aymaras en el Alto, en La Paz, que también participaron en la defensa del agua.
In that struggle, a 17-year-old boy named Víctor
Hugo
Daza was killed along with four indigenous aymara in El Alto.
Every November in the United States is a mass protest against the School of the Americas. That's the old name for it. Were there any connections with the soldiers and the school?
Cada noviembre en Estados Unidos hay una protesta contra la Escuela de las Américas. Es el antiguo nombre del base. ¿Hubo conexiones entre ellos y lo que pasó en Cochabamba?
Claro. En ese momento, el presidente de Bolivia, el año 2000, era Hugo Banzer Suárez, que asistió a la Escuela de las Américas. El gobernador, no, el alcalde en Cochabamba en ese tiempo, Manfred Reyes Villas, asistió a la Escuela de las Américas. Y el militar que mató a este joven también fue alumno de la Escuela de las Américas.
Of course, there were connections. At that time, the president, Hugo Banza Suárez, and the mayor of Cochabamba had gone to the School of the Americas, and also the soldier who actually killed the youth, who we mentioned, also had been a graduate of the School of the Americas.
Finally, today, you are in the United States meeting with trade union leaders. What are you doing with them?
Ahora está en Estados Unidos para juntarse con líderes sindicalistas en Estados Unidos. ¿Qué va a hacer? ¿Qué está haciendo con ellos?
Estamos, como dice este programa, queriendo una democracia ahora, todos.
What we want, as the program says, is democracy now for everyone.
Hoy deberíamos estar en esta mesa redonda cinco personas. Solo estamos cuatro.
Today there should be five people at this round table, but instead there's only four.
La democracia, la mejor democracia del mundo, que supuestamente es Estados Unidos de Norteamérica.
The best democracy in the world, which supposedly is the United States of America.
No permitió que Juan Patricio Quispe, el hermano de una persona que fue asesinada en octubre del 2003, esté aquí.
The government of the United States did not permit that Juan Patricio Quispe, the brother of a man who was killed in 2003, could come here today.
La embajada norteamericana negó la visa para que él pueda venir aquí a dar un testimonio del padecimiento de la gente.
The American embassy refused to give him a visa so that he could come and give his testimony about the suffering of the people.
Pero el gobierno de Estados Unidos permite la permanencia de Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada aquí.
But the government of the United States allows the presence of Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada to be here.
Y evita y no quiere darle la comunicación para que él responda por las acusaciones que tiene en Bolivia.
And they don't even want to give him the paper of notification so that he has to respond to the accusations in Bolivia.
Where does he live here?
¿Dónde vive aquí?
En Washington.
D.C.
D.C. Y nosotros vamos a hacer una acción prontamente en el lugar donde vive Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada, exigiendo al gobierno de Estados Unidos y pidiendo al pueblo norteamericano que puedan ayudarnos para que se haga justicia en Bolivia.
And soon we're going to do an action at his house to demand to the government and to ask to the American people that they help us in bringing Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada to justice.
I want to thank you both very much for being here. When will you do that at Losada's house?
Gracias por venir aquí. ¿Cuándo va a ser esa acción en la casa de Losada?
Va a ser este fin de semana.
It's going to be this weekend.
Well, we will cover the events. I want to thank you both for joining us, Oscar Olivera. We've spoken to you on the phone. It's good to have you in our studio. And Rogelia Mehta, we will continue to follow your attempts to have the former president and two ministers of Bolivia extradited. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we move into this fifth anniversary of the attack on Afghanistan, we'll speak with an Afghan-American reporter about the latest in her country. Stay with us. Harim Karati here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Afghanistan, NATO's now taken command of most foreign troops across the country. The handover of power comes just days before the fifth anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. The U.S. continues to have more troops than any other country in Afghanistan. The U.S. will also retain full control of Bagram Air Force Base, where the Bush administration is holding hundreds of prisoners. This is Don Everts, NATO's senior civilian representative in Afghanistan.
NATO's mission in Afghanistan is challenging. That said, we know that the challenges in Afghanistan cannot be met by international military forces or security operations alone. Enhanced security must go hand in hand with the reconstruction and development efforts and effective, transparent governance. This is the only way to fight extremism, to extend the influence of democratic governance, and to improve the lives of the people of Afghanistan.
Earlier this week, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist admitted the war against the Taliban might never be won. He said there are now too many Taliban fighters and they have too much popular support. Frist said backers of the Taliban should be brought into the Afghan government. In recent months, the Taliban seized control of entire regions of the country. The security situation has worsened as suicide bombings are up 600% this year. Opium and poppy cultivation are at record highs. Our next guest has closely monitored the U.S. reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan. She's author of a study published by CorpWatch called Afghanistan, Inc., that examines the reconstruction efforts of companies like Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root, KBR, DynCorp, Blackwater, the Lewis Berger Group, and the Rendon Group. Her name is Fariba Nawa. She is an Afghan-American journalist who's lived in Afghanistan for most of the past 3 years. Born in Afghanistan, she fled the country at the age of 8. At the time of the September 11th attacks, Fariba was living in New York. Soon after, she decided to return to her home country as a journalist. Fariba Nawa now joins us from San Francisco. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the state of your home country, Afghanistan, 5 years after the U.S.-led invasion?
Well, it is not in a good position right now. I think it's worse than it's ever been since the 2001 topple of the Taliban, and it's going to get worse. From my research and my time in Afghanistan, people are leaving again. Refugees who had come back are leaving again in large numbers and selling their homes. A lot of the diaspora who went back, like myself, were very hopeful that there would be sustainable change, but that isn't going to happen. So even people like myself are coming back. And it's a dire situation right now. Security, reconstruction. Reconstruction has been, for the most part, a failure, I would say. And that goes hand in hand with how security has gotten worse over the years.
Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, his comments that backers of the Taliban should be brought into the Afghan government. Your response?
You know, I think I would have to think about that a lot more before I say yes or no to that, because I don't think the Taliban are a primarily Afghan movement. I think Afghanistan and Pakistan are so closely linked right now, and many of the suicide bombers, for example, have not been Afghan. They've been Chechens, they've been Arabs, they've been Pakistanis, and at the end of the day, it's very hard to tell who's Afghan, who's not, when you have a huge border that is basically a Pashtun border. And whether they have popular support, now I've lived there and I speak the local languages, especially in the urban areas, they do not have popular support. I think it's a misconception to say that the Afghans want the Taliban to come back. They were not happy with the Taliban. That's not an accurate statement. I think maybe in the southern villages where nothing has changed, and it never did, girls never went to school. Women were never able to work, then perhaps that's where the popular support is. But for a large part of the country, people are very afraid that the Taliban are going to come back and going to have another reign of terror like they did before.
Fariha Benawa, talk about Afghanistan Inc. Talk about the report that you've just issued and name names. Talk about the companies with the largest contracts and what's happening.
The largest contractor in Afghanistan is the Lewis Berger Group. It's an engineering consulting company out of New Jersey, and they received initially $665 million for a period of 4 or 5 years, and they were given the task of infrastructure. And under that was building and rebuilding schools and clinics, roads, electricity, dams, and they did a horrendous job, and it is in the report, the details are in the report about how some of their projects failed. They had a few success stories, but for the most part, the things they did do well, or the things they did do, they did not do well. The quality was bad for a lot of money. They were supposed to build clinics where they didn't even know where the clinics were. School roofs collapsed before they were ever used. Roads that were built were falling apart before they were ever used. And this is with American taxpayers' money. And then how were they reprimanded for this? They weren't. They were awarded another $1.4 billion contract with another company called Black & Veatch just this summer to continue doing their work in an infrastructure and also bring power to Afghanistan through Uzbekistan. And that is an unacceptable thing, because their track record showed that they couldn't do the job well. And that's what Afghanistan Inc. talks about, is the specifics of reconstruction, how the money comes, where does it come from, where is it going, how is it being wasted. For the most part, the $10 billion that was donated to Afghanistan from the international community for the last 5 years has been mismanaged and wasted. Much of it has come back to the donor nations through corporations, and there's an estimate, I don't know how accurate this is, that only 30% of that money has actually reached the ground on projects. So that is what the report goes into. Other companies that I talk about are Dyncor, Halliburton, you mentioned, the Rendon Group, Chemonix, which is an agricultural group. These are mostly USAID-funded projects, but also State Department and Pentagon.
You also talk about Blackwater. What is its role there?
Blackwater is a security it's training the Afghan counter-narcotics forces. And they had a lawsuit against them about it was a helicopter crash that involved a pilot who wasn't trained well enough. But I didn't focus on Blackwater that much, so I'm not very comfortable talking about that. Mm-hmm.
And what is the attitude of Afghanis towards these U.S. corporations?
Well, there's a misunderstanding about the private sector and the public. So Afghans seem to think that they're all NGOs, and the NGOs are all bad because they're not doing anything. But that's because there is a lack of information about these private contractors. And the private contractors do work with NGOs. For example, Chemonix works with 40 NGOs, and Chemonix is the funder. And Afghans are very upset because they don't see the results they were looking for. That said, there has been a lot of progress. You see houses being built. You see people who work, you know, there is more work than there was during the Taliban period. I mean, there's no argument that life has gotten better for a lot of the people in the cities, especially in the north and the west, since the Taliban left. But still, I mean, the riots that happened in June, where, you know, there were many buildings were on fire and there were people going down the street saying death to America, death to Karzai, that was, for the most part, popular sentiment. But that doesn't mean they want, you know, I don't find the resistance movement right now that's there a legitimate Afghan resistance. So when, you know, when I hear politicians talking about it that way, I tend to disagree.
Can you talk about the issue of poppy and opium production today?
Okay. Afghanistan produces the largest amount of opium in the world, and opium is refined into heroin. It is funding the insurgency. That includes, you know, whoever's opposed to the government, whether it's Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, who was a former Mujahideen member and received a large amount of cash from the United States to fight against the Soviets. That is the Taliban, that is the Arab fighters who are going there. I'm sure poppy money is being used to fight the Americans in Iraq. But it's also funding reconstruction, ironically. And a lot of the drug lords, for example, are building clinics up in the north. People find them doing things that they didn't expect. Sort of a Pablo Escobar-ish effect that happened in Medellin, and I think in Colombia, is happening in Afghanistan. Many people are calling it a narco state now. So it's about, it's arguably 60% of the GDP right now.
We only have about 30 seconds, but I wanted to ask you about the women of Afghanistan, where they stand today versus 5 years ago.
In the cities, better off. Again, I think there's a big rural-urban divide there, and always has been, but very, very scared right now. There was a euphoria right after the Taliban were gone. Women were on TV singing, you know, able to wear what they wanted. But now there's a fear because Women's Affairs Director from Kandahar was just assassinated last week. And events like that really bring it home that it's not the same anymore. The euphoria is definitely gone, and people are afraid.
Fariba Nawa, I want to thank you for being with us. I'd like to have you back to talk more extensively about your own reporting for the years that you went back to Afghanistan, almost kidnapped, facing a lot of adversity, but you remain there. And I want to thank you for being with us today. Afghan-American journalist who's lived for most of the past 3 years in Afghanistan has just come out with a report with Corp Watch called Afghanistan, Inc., and we'll link to it at Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Aaron Matei, Jen Yutz, Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Tonight I'll be on the Colbert Report. Tune in. I'd like to get your comments. Oh, that's rapport. Also, tomorrow we'll be in Ashland, Oregon, and on Saturday, all day in California, Sunday in Vermont, Burlington. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.